This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week on our Week in Review with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, our old friend Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Great to have you back. Brent, before we start, just wanted to give you the opportunity to give us a little update of how things are going over there with the start of the archaeological dig.
Yeah, I think we're about 2 weeks in now to actual excavation, and it's been exciting. The two areas where we're digging, just below the southern wall of the Temple Mount, are very important as far as Jerusalem's history goes, and the students there are taking right to the work. We haven't reached too many clean layers yet. As we start, you generally have to clean up the area, and then you're excavating through it's ancient dirt, but a lot of the time you have modern penetrations into it, and so we're still trying to get to mostly clean layers, which will generally start us about the Byzantine period, about 1500 years ago, before we go further down once we go through those. But not too many, well, not really any discoveries as yet, still just really trying to take off those top layers before we hopefully uncover some amazing things.
I've been in contact with some of the students over there, and they're definitely adjusting to the rigors of the rock breaking and the back breaking work that they're doing. You can tell that it's a bit of an adjustment for them, but it is exciting to see them involved.
It is a hard schedule for them. They have to get up nice and early. We leave for the dig around 5:45 in the morning. And then by 2:30, they're pretty wasted, but then they have to come back and do classes and other things. So we keep them busy here. It's a good life, but there's not that much time for anything else apart from work and classes.
Yeah. Well, in honor of your return, I guess it's been a couple of weeks since we've been able to have you. We're going to start the show today with a couple of stories about the Middle East. U.S. President Donald Trump has not been treating the Palestinians the way they're accustomed to being treated by an American president. He's been cutting funding to Palestinian groups. He recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Palestinian leaders have been calling to cut America out of the peace process, and the likeliest candidate to replace America in that role is Europe. The Palestinians are asking for this. Europe at least seems open to possibilities. And for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Mike Pence's visit to Israel obviously captured a lot of international attention when he was traveling around there. During that visit, the Palestinian Authority refused to meet with him. And at the same time, Mahmoud Abbas was in Europe, traveling around and visiting various different individuals, most particularly European, basically Europe's foreign minister, Federica Mogherini, who tries to coordinate foreign policy for the group and who's long wanted a view in Israel. And the Palestinians have been very clear. They've said, we will not go back to a negotiation that's just us, United States and Israel. We're not going to do that again. They've had several different officials come out and say that. And so instead, they're looking at getting Europe involved. The Al Monitor quoted some anonymous sources within the Palestinian Authority. They said they're looking at doing the P5+1 formula and pushing for that for peace process negotiations, which, if you remember from the Iran deal, that's the five permanent member states of the United Nations Security Council, Russia, China, America, Britain, and France, and then the plus one, Germany. So you've got, if you include Britain, half of that's within the European Union right now. France and Germany, they're giving them a strong voice in that. And the other one they've talked about doing is the quartet, which was the EU, the UN, the US, and Russia. So they're looking at doing these multilateral negotiations, and Europe is saying the same thing. So they had another important meeting on negotiations on Wednesday, a high-level meeting between the EU and US officials in Brussels. That was to do with how they fund the Palestinian groups. But Federica Mogherini basically, well, she said, if I can put it in the headline, nothing without the United States, nothing with the United States alone. So they're also saying the same, exactly the same message as the Palestinians. No more negotiations of just Palestinians, Israel, US. It's got to have other people involved. And of course, the subtext behind all of that is it's got to have Europe involved. So Palestinians putting its foot down, saying, we want Europe involved. Europe saying, we want to be involved in all peace negotiations from now on.
This is something that we have concentrated a lot of attention on over the years, and looking for Europe to insert itself into the Middle East peace process. Before we talk about some of the reasons why that is the case, can you just talk about Israel's perspective watching this happen? Obviously, it's Palestinians who are calling for this. Israel has been quite happy with its relationship with the United States lately, and is glad to see some of these policies coming out of the Trump administration. How does it view these calls for more European involvement?
I haven't seen where they've spoken about this specifically. I mean, obviously, yes, it does seem like they would prefer to negotiate just with the United States. They're quite happy with Donald Trump. They're quite happy with what Donald Trump said about the moving the embassy. I think 90% of Israelis said they view the United States as a good partner. They're the most pro-American country on earth, I think, according to that survey.
So, more than America,
yes,
is.
Apart from America, right. Well, maybe even more pro-America. I don't know whether you get 90% of Americans saying...
No, definitely not. Not even close to 90% here.
So they're happy. But having said that, first of all, you've got to think about how they've constantly given way to the Palestinians. And you could see them just going along with it. If the Palestinians say... there's time after time Israel has given in to what the Palestinian Authority say they want and preconditions. If they say we'll only have negotiations if you have, say, the EU and Russia involved, you could see Israel going with that. The other thing is, if you look at, well, Carolyn Glick had a great piece drawing attention to this about a week ago. But you look at some of the, especially a Pew survey that was done recently in the United States, and it showed that... Okay, support for Israel within America has stayed relatively constant, but there's been a massive shift in that support, even so. And what's happened is it's become much more polarized. Republicans have become much more pro-Israel, and Democrats have become much more anti-Israel, especially the left wing of the Democratic Party that's really in the ascendancy right now has become dramatically more anti-Israel and more pro-Palestinian just in the last year or two. And her conclusion, she writes, if President Trump is not president in January 2021, Israel will face an administration that will make us miss Obama. Even more anti, they're saying, look at where the trends are going. If a Democrat wins the next election, Israel is going to be facing with an even more anti-Israel administration than Mr. Obama's was. And so you could also see them thinking, well, we've got to hedge our bets a bit. Mm-hmm. Yes, the United States is a great friend with us right now, but we can't put all our eggs in that basket, because what if 4 years or however 3 years down the line and there's a new election and a new president, we'll be stuck. We could be in big trouble if we're just relying on the United States. So you can see that being another factor that could cause Israel to go along with what the Palestinians want and look to Europe and more bring Europe in.
Yeah, or in the words of John Kerry, as he was having this meeting with a Palestinian leader in London, maybe President Trump won't be in office a year from now, and he's trying to undercut American Middle East diplomacy and promising something to the Palestinians that, again, you could see Israel eyeballing this situation and saying, well, how are we supposed to guarantee our long-term interests if we don't at least... open ourselves up to the possibility of other actors being a part of this process. So it is something that we've watched a lot. Explain why this is so important for us to look at.
So this is something that's referenced across a whole host of different scriptures. And you can put several together, and there's Hosea 5 talks about the nation of Judah turning to Assyria or modern-day Germany for a peace process. Daniel 11 talks about European armies entering, and the way that it uses the language there, it talks about them entering peaceably into Jerusalem. The implication is they're there to keep the peace. So there's several of these different prophecies that refer to a Europe that gets that Israel turns to Europe for help in the peace process, and that Europe provides that help. And this that help is it's a key stepping point. It's something even that Jesus Christ himself references. He quotes Daniel 11. He references that prophecy as one of the key events leading into his return to this earth. So it's something that's confirmed and referenced throughout the Bible. Now, if you want to kind of put some of those together, we have an article on our website right now called Can Europe Broker Peace in the Middle East by Callum Wood. That goes through some of those prophecies. It also includes three different of our 90-second videos that are great for just giving you a quick overview of some of these important prophecies if you've not really heard much about them. So that can be a great place to quickly get caught up on this story and on the prophecy behind this story. But this is such an important prophecy that we have a booklet that talks a lot about it. The Jerusalem in Prophecy booklet has a whole chapter. That chapter is called Israel's Deadly Wound, about this peace process, about how Europe will get involved. So you can go much more in depth by getting that booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
All right. Well, we'll put links to all of those articles and videos on the show notes for the program today if you just visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Richard. We're going to move over to Brent here. Israel really should be concerned about Israel increasing its role in the peace process. We're going to slip in a quick story related to this point as Polish lawmakers pass a controversial bill that Israelis say tries to rewrite Holocaust-era history. For this, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is a really interesting law that all it needs right now, I think, is the signature of the prime minister there. And so what this law does is it outlaws I'll just read what the law is. It says, whoever accuses publicly and against the facts the Polish nation or the Polish state of being responsible or complicit in the Nazi crimes committed by the Third German Reich or other crimes against humanity and so on and so forth, you can be imprisoned for up to 3 years. So basically, the Poles have kind of been sick of people referring to the different concentration camps in their nations that the Germans set up and run, the extermination camps. A lot of the famous ones are inside Poland. And so they have designed a law that will forbid anyone in their nation for talking about these Polish death camps, in quotes, since they don't like that terminology. Yet Israelis are up in arms because this law goes far further than just referencing that statement alone. And it says that if you come out and state that the Poles had anything to do or were complicit in Nazi crimes against Jews in their country, then you can face up to 3 years of jail time. This is quite serious because it essentially puts the kibosh on freedom of speech relating to investigating Poland during World War II. Hmm. And there have been a number of books that have come out in the last couple of years. I think Melanie Phillips has one that's going to be published in April, actually, which documents the Polish, some of the Poles being accessories to what Germany was doing, what the Nazis were doing against the Jews, many Poles rounding up some of their Jewish neighbors. I think up to the tune of 200,000 Jews were either directly or indirectly put to death by the aid of Polish citizens. And yet, if you were to write that, if this law goes through, and it looks like it will from now on, you could face up to 3 years in prison in Poland.
So what do you make of this, Brent? Why is Poland doing this? First of all, there is some evidence as to why Poland responded or why they kind of fast-tracked this bill. But what do you make of the fact that they're prioritizing establishing this somewhat, like you said, kind of an authoritarian-type law here, limiting freedom of speech and just the free flow of facts in spite of Israeli objections and even American objections?
Right. Well, you could look at this a couple of ways. I think it is in relation to Poland's growing nationalism. It doesn't want to it wants to separate itself in some ways from Germany's dirty past. And it views itself. No country wants to look at its history and claim that there were many atrocities that it were a party to. And so I think that's part of it as well. We can look at it I believe it's interesting to look at it just in terms of the rise of anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, just kind of looking at the Holocaust as another episode of man's hatred against man, when really this was a once in a millennia event, and it was perpetrated specifically against the Jews. There's no type of Melanie Phillips goes into this and talks about how there's this growing sense of victimization in this world, how everyone wants to be a victim, and this Poles are a victim of Germany, and indeed they were. I'm not saying the Poles weren't. Indeed, they were a victim of German Nazism. But to then say that there is some type of moral relativity between what happened to the Jews to the other parties in World War II would be to belittle that act of the Holocaust against the Jews. And so I think we're seeing this all over. I think this was recently that the person that designed the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin was talking about recently, I think it was last year or so, just how much that how much they would like to forget that history in part and just move on and stop bringing it up. And yet we know when people forget the history of what they've done inside their nation, that that history is more able to repeat itself. And so I think the broader point here is how anti-Semitism, I believe, is resurfacing. And we are seeing nations rewrite their own history in terms of what they have done to the Jews.
Yeah, not at all difficult to see why Israel would be so upset about this. And it's hard not to view this in light of all of the other trends that we're seeing within Europe and many nations, and the populace is the voting public within many European nations that are taking a more anti-Israel view. You would think that Israelis would have to be watching what's happening there very closely when it comes to considering just how much it wants European leaders involved in the peace process and how much it's going to actually entrust its fortunes to Europeans. But it doesn't seem like it tends to have a whole lot of effect on official policy within Israel. If someone wanted more information about why we watch this so closely and this undercurrent of anti-Semitism that we see within Europe in particular, where would you send them, Brent?
I would just go to, there's a really good chapter inside the Key of David booklet written by our editor-in-chief, and it talks about the fundamental roots of anti-Semitism, why it exists, why the Jews have been singled out throughout history as a target. And it goes into why that happened in World War II as well. So I think most thinking people would look at the Jews and say, yeah, they have disproportionately been attacked by other nations. Why is that so? That booklet, Key of David, will provide you with that answer.
Thank you for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. A warning from the Pentagon says that American satellites are at risk from anti-satellite missiles in development, missiles that could be operational quite soon. And which nations are working on this technology aimed at targeting satellites as part of their war-making capabilities? To learn the answer, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Pentagon's Joint Staff Intelligence Directorate issued this warning in a January 30th report. And the report is sobering and even alarming, really. The main conclusion of it says, quote, China and Russia will be capable of severely disrupting or destroying U.S. satellites in low Earth orbit, end quote. And the report goes into quite a bit of specific detail about the weapons in question that both Russia and China have quite far along in the development process. It mentions ground-launched missiles that can go into space. It also talks about lasers and electronic jammers. And then it also talks about small maneuvering satellites that the Russian and Chinese militaries could actually maneuver right up to another country's satellite and then grab it out of orbit and crush it. Right there in space. So it's some really advanced weaponry that Moscow and Beijing have in the works, and these weapons will be operational by 2020, according to this report. So that's less than 2 years away. And the Joint Staff is not the only part of the U.S. government that's worried about this. This January 30th report echoes warnings that were issued back in May by the Director of National Intelligence. So more and more U.S. experts are coming to see just how immediate and how grave this threat is, and it's becoming a real cause of concern for a lot of analysts.
So give us an idea, Jeremiah, of the kind of damage that Russia and China could do against the United States if they acquire this technology.
Well, the type of satellites that are in question here are low Earth orbit satellites. These operate between 100 miles off the surface of the planet and 1,200 miles. And they're used for all kinds of reconnaissance, communication, and observation. Many of these give us vital military data used for things like deploying forces in a conflict and preparing battlefields. And then many of America's major communication satellites are also in low orbit. The ones for Iridium and Global Star and Orbcomm are all in this area that these new weapons would be able to target.
I'm not familiar with those companies. What are those communications companies?
Yes, that's right.
For like civilian communication?
I believe they do a lot of civilian communication, and then they also would help with military communications as well and other government entities. Mm-hmm. So these are really vital components of geolocation and precision and communication technology. And it's not just the military that's heavily reliant on these, but all kinds of civilian and other government entities. Steve Lambakis, who is a former Pentagon missile expert, said, quote, "This vulnerable infrastructure is worth billions of dollars and is vital to nearly every activity of the U.S. and increasingly the armed forces of U.S. allies." So it's really a concerning threat.
So for Russia and China to be developing this technology this way, and you really do have to view this as primarily aimed at the United States, don't you? I mean, what other countries are that reliant, as reliant as the United States is, on satellite technology of this type?
Well, yes, the U.S. would lead the list there, but the world is trending that way. Most nations with advanced militaries and economies of any kind would be deploying, you know, dozens of satellites every year to boost their technologies across a wide range of activities. But the U.S. would top the list.
So just viewing this in light of the other aggressive activity, we talk about quite a lot just how much Russia and China both are leveraging their power in several other arenas. We were talking last week or earlier this week about China's activities on the sea. This is another dimension to Russia and China's war-making capability that really could have dramatic impact on the warfare of the future.
Yes, that's right. Space is an increasingly vital battlefield for a war of the future. It's a place where a lot of decisive conflicts could happen. So this is, it's definitely alarming.
How do you look at this in light of the prophecies that we're studying with respect to what Russia and China are going to accomplish in the future?
Well, we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. And one quote from that booklet says, "It is evident that both Russian and Chinese officials are working to form a new alliance and counter American dominance of world affairs." And this booklet goes into many details showing that the Bible prophesied of the rise of Russia and China in the end time and of their rising military might and of how they would play a big role in the end time in the most violent war that mankind has ever experienced. So when we see these two nations developing these kinds of anti-satellite weapons, and really this goes along with just the general picture of their military rise, And this threatens not just American stability, but global stability. And so we should really see that as setting the stage for this prophesied World War III. And we will have a link to Russia and China in Prophecy in our show notes. And we're happy to send that out for free to anyone who would like to know more about these Bible prophecies and just understand how they're being fulfilled in the headlines that we see all the time.
Thank you, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. This week, the United States President Donald Trump delivered his first State of the Union address. Stephen Fleury talked about this on Wednesday's Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and he's written an article for thetrumpet.com about it, discussing what it tells you about, in particular, the divisions plaguing America right now. We'll get a summary look at the speech from Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, there's problems in many parts of the world, but if you listen to the State of the Union address on Tuesday, you'll know that in America, at least, absolutely everything is wonderful. Black unemployment is lower than it's ever been in history. Hispanic unemployment is lower than it's ever been in history. Unemployment overall is lower than it's ever been in a long time. The stock market is up. ISIS is defeated, and just many other wonderful things. You've got a plan to crack down on drug addiction, a plan to crack down on illegal immigration. But as Mr. Flory brings out in his Trumpet radio program from this Wednesday, there's a lot of other things that didn't get talked about in the State of the Union address, and that's somewhat to be expected. I think Abraham Lincoln's the last president I can remember who actually just got up and said, things are bad, people need to repent. pretty much everyone since then has obviously painted their administration in very glowing terms. But this is something that, you know, there is a plan to build infrastructure, but as Mr. Trump said in his speech, it's going to cost $1.5 trillion. What he didn't mention in his speech is, we're already running multi-hundred-billion-dollar deficits each year and have $20 trillion in debt. So where's that money coming from? How are we going to be able to pay the interest payments? Because the math says that within a decade, the interest payments are going to be consuming pretty much all of America's individual income tax filings.
Yeah.
Or other things. ISIS may have been on the down and out, but Iran's moved into Syria and it's taken its place. That didn't come up in the State of the Union address. He's got a plan to crack down on drug addiction, where just assuming that if you get this wall built, that people won't be able to get drugs into this country, but there's a supply and demand issue there as to, like, why is there a demand for all these drugs pouring into this country? Because as long as the broken families that create that demand continue, you'll find a submarine or a catapult or whatever you need to get around that wall, which frankly probably won't be built anyway because of the political division in the country. That's actually one of the more shocking things to me, is even seeing that the president, he caved on a lot of his campaign promises. He told the Democrats that I'm going to let 1.8 million illegal immigrants who came here as children have amnesty, which is like three times as much as the Obama administration gave amnesty.
Right.
In return for this wall. And so even though this is going to be one of the biggest amnesty bills in history, if he does this, the Democrats, they still they didn't get up or clap or cheer. Yep. They said they're really angry at the fact that he even wants a wall in return for giving them this huge amnesty bill. It was never about.
Yeah, it's really a bizarre moment in the State of the Union that you had Republicans wildly cheering, you know, $1.5 trillion in infrastructure payouts, 1.8 million immigrants being made American citizens, and they're applauding, and the Democrats aren't interested at all. They're not moved an inch as they're listening to these policies being laid out by a Republican president. Quite extraordinary.
Right. But those are two great examples, the infrastructure bill and the amnesty bill are two things the Democrats really wanted President Obama to do. He wasn't able to do them. Now President Trump's promised to go even far beyond what they wanted president to do with an even bigger infrastructure bill and an even bigger amnesty bill. And they're still
no
just
dice.
Really upset, no dice, just due to the fact that he's like, well, if I grant this amnesty bill, I want a wall so we don't have to do another amnesty bill just like it 10 years from now when more come.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to mention, it just seems like there's so much personal animus there that prevents them from supporting anything that he says. If it was a different person up there saying exactly the same thing, even with the wall, you would bet that they would be on board with it.
Yeah, Mr. Stephen Flair brought that out in his program, I believe, that it would be kind of a neat experiment if to see if he read off one of President Obama's State of the Union speeches
right.
word for word
right.
and see what the reaction was simply because it was coming from President Trump.
Yeah. So I would really recommend that you go and listen to Stephen Fleury's Trumpet Daily Radio Show from Wednesday. Also, his article, you can read this as we post it. I think it's meant to be posted here shortly, if it hasn't been already, What You Should Know About President Trump's State of the Union Address. He just goes through the speech point by point, makes a lot of really, really good points throughout that article that it's worth looking at. And also take a look at Gerald Fleury's article, Great Again. Stephen Fleury quotes that booklet and some of the statements that Gerald Fleury made at the beginning of the Trump presidency about what we can expect to see. And we're seeing seeing these things unfold now in real time. So really exciting to see how this is following the path that Gerald Fleury laid out in that booklet. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Iran projects its power throughout the Middle East, an expose about how Germany has been covering up its trade surpluses, the Vatican betraying Catholics in China, and China running re-education camps right out of the playbook of Mao Zedong. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
In these recent protests we've seen in the Islamic Republic of Iran, many of the chants that you've heard from everyday Iranians on the street were about how the government was prioritizing its aggressive activities in other nations, in Syria and Lebanon and Israel and Yemen and so on, over taking care of their own people. And what these folks were saying drew attention to a truth that we've been closely watching for a long time here at the Trumpet. The means by which Iran projects its power throughout the region in fulfillment of biblical prophecy. To learn more about this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and hear from Brent Noctegal.
There was an important piece that was written this week for Carnegie's Endowment for International Peace, and it's entitled Tehran's Shia Foreign Legions. And as you've said, it does document quite well just how much Iran uses foreign nationals to project its power across the Middle East. Of course, they're funded out of Tehran. They're funded by Iran's government. And yet a lot of these fighters on behalf of Iran, they're not Iranians. And this goes through the number of deaths that have taken place over the past, I guess, 7 years or 6 years, ever since 2012, when the Syrian civil war began. And it looks at Syria and Iraq in particular, and how Iran has dominated those nations through the use of different proxies. That's what we call them, generally proxy powers that are funded and directed by Iran. And we talk about them, especially we talk about Hezbollah. Of course, that is a proxy power of Iran. A lot of money goes to Hezbollah. They're extremely well-equipped and extremely just they're really good fighters when it comes to hand-to-hand, well, urban warfare, basically, and the type of fighting that they've experienced with Israel for so many years. And this piece just brings out that over the deaths that have taken place over the past 8 years or 7 years on the Iranian side, only 20% of those were actually Iranian nationals. The rest of them were Lebanese nationals, Afghani nationals, Pakistanis, Iraqis, all fighting under the banner of Iran. And this doesn't include Bashar al-Assad's men. It doesn't include any Russian deaths. It actually only includes those that answer directly to Tehran. Hmm. And this is important for people to notice, because we talk about Iran dominating the Middle East. We talk about how they do this and Iran's actions in different countries. But Iran's not there. Iran doesn't send over its people generally to fight these wars. But they are fought by Iranian supporters or people that are directly under Iran's control. Mm-hmm. And this article goes through a few of those. Hezbollah being for one. They've lost about 1,200 men in the past 6 years in Syria. That's a lot of fighters. Iran has only lost about 500. So Hezbollah takes the cake there over their own people. You can look at the Shiite militias that answer to Iran. 2,500 of them have died for the sake of Iran. Then the Afghani division. There's over 800 of them. And so you can see that there is this huge swath of land that does go from Pakistan all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, where Iran has military power, armies under its control in foreign nations. And that's why they can exert so much power.
So we focus a lot of attention on the prophecy in Daniel 11 and verse 40 about a king of the south. And there are people who, looking at that prophecy, you know, we've been talking about that for over two decades, and they might dispute the identity of who that is. We've been talking about Iran for a long time, but when you look at what Iran is doing here, you can see there is no other nation that is doing what Iran is doing on anywhere near this type of scale.
Yeah, not at all. And we do have some people that will write in and talk about how, well, just look at what Saudi Arabia is doing across the Middle East, because you have they're the leader of the Sunni states, you could say, and then you have Iran leading the Shiites. And yet Saudi Arabia isn't able to project its power like this into other nations at all, because the radical Islamists that are on the Sunni radical Islamists, they want to overthrow the Saudi government. They're actually trying to do that. They are not directed by the Saudi government, where Iran and its fighters, the Shiite fighters, they answer directly to the actual government, legitimate, well, whatever, their government inside Iran. And so we can't have, there is no equivalence between Sunni fighters backed by the Saudis and Shiite fighters backed by Iran. And that's why Iran can push into these other nations and in some cases deny that it's them, because they're using nationals inside those states. If you're talking about Hezbollah, they're Lebanese nationals. And Iran could say, well, they're doing what's best for Lebanon. But if you look at where the money comes from, the money always goes back to Iran. And if you look at where the direction comes from, the guidance, the spiritual leadership, and even the objective, the military objectives, they come from Iran as well. Iran is fully equipped to project its power all across the Middle East. If it wants to destabilize Egypt, it can do so, sending fighters there, even supporting financially, even Egyptian radicals in that country. Saudi Arabia can't do that like Iran can, and that's why Iran has dominated the Middle East and will continue to do so for the near future.
This is the type of evidence that so many countries, as Iran has become more legitimate since the nuclear deal was struck and they've been doing more business with Iran, type of evidence that these nations would want to overlook. I just think it's so interesting that it's the people on the Iranian street who are making this point and speaking out about this, even though the Iranian government may deny some of these activities. The people on the street know it. The Iranian people understand what's going on here, and it's out in the open. If only people would open their eyes and look at it and admit the truth of what is happening here, we'd have a whole lot more clarity in our policy with Iran.
For sure. And yeah, where did the money go? I mean, Iran got a lot of money from the nuclear deal, a lot of investment from Europe, from China. Where has that money gone? Obviously, the riots are proof that the people in Tehran, throughout Iran, didn't get it. It went to its foreign legions across the Middle East. If anyone would like to read up about this, of course, you can go to our booklet, King of the South. You can also look for a forthcoming trend article that's currently in the editing process entitled Iran Leading the Rise of Islamic Terrorism. That should be available hopefully in the next week or two. So I don't know if we can put a link for that, but be looking out for that article in the future.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Brent. President Trump has been gearing up for a showdown with Europe over trade, and a new expose by German economists has the potential to ramp up these tensions over trade between the U.S. and Germany in particular. For this story, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, so just a little over a week ago, a couple of economists within Germany, one of whom, Heiner Flassbeck, was a former state secretary of finance, took a deep look at some of the statistics coming out of Germany's official statistics agency. And their conclusion is that Germany is, quote, cooking the books, that the government is deliberately misreporting the statistics, and that actually Germany is exporting even more than they claim they are, and that its economy is even more dependent on exports than they say they are. They say it's hard to know for sure, but they estimate based on those statistics that about 80 to 90% of Germany's economic growth last year came from its exports. And this is a, you know, this is a very hot button issue right now. America, just over a year ago, began criticizing Germany for its trade imbalances, saying that it was relying on exports too much. There's a very strong argument that the way Germany's economy is geared towards exports violates European Union rules as well. And what they say is basically you look into these statistics and it's not just a simple reporting case where they go and they measure something and they publish it. There are a whole load of estimates. There are a whole load of judgments and different calls that you make about measuring inflation and things like that, that you can shift the statistics through a huge range depending on what figures you want. And these organizations have come up with the most politically expedient statistics that seem to imply that Germany's economy is less export driven than is actually the case.
So all of the things that are creating these tensions, not only between the United States and Germany, but even within the European Union and other European countries that are looking at Germany's in these trade imbalances and the way that it's using the euro and the eurozone as a means of propping up its own economy, they're all going to look at this and say, well, the problem is even worse than we had thought that it was. What are the ramifications? What's the fallout from that?
Well, I don't know whether these two economists' report will get picked up to that extent. I'm not sure. And so it may well be that the official statistics are able to continue to stand. It's kind of the, I think it's the kind of thing that ends up just getting revised quietly a few months down the road with less fanfare than, you know, what was it that Churchill said? The truth goes halfway around, or the lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets a chance to get its boots on. I don't know whether they'll ever get called out on some of these statistics. But yes, you can certainly see Donald Trump he's talked a lot about cracking down on Europe. He talks about a fair bit on that at Davos. He is talking very seriously about about placing tariffs on European steel, which is something that would hit the whole of the EU particularly hard. So you could see that this issue leading not just Germany into kind of a trade war with the United States, but dragging all of the rest of Europe in there with them. I think, though, in a lot of ways, this trade war has already started. It's been going on for years and years and years, that Germany, just the whole way the euro is structured, gives them a huge advantage compared to where they would be where they're using the Deutschmark. Just in almost exactly the same way that China keeps their currency artificially low, and which then makes all of their goods artificially cheaper, which makes any American imports into China artificially more expensive. So I think for both of these countries, they have been operating a trade war against the United States for years. They've just been doing it much more subtly. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Trump's response will not be subtle. And so what you're getting is, okay, from maybe a one-sided trade war to potentially a two-sided trade war, and something that we could escalate and become much more obvious.
Where do we go for more information, Richard?
Well, just about a year ago, Trumpet contributing editor Brad McDonald had an article, Trade Wars Have Begun. It was the cover issue, I think, of our April 2017 magazine. That's a great place to go to read some of the background on these trade wars, and then to get some of the Bible prophecy behind it, because there are some very specific reasons from the Bible that we are watching this. The Bible talks about a trade war between the United States and a trading bloc of nations led by Europe and by China as being a very important prophecy, a very important milestone in prophetic events. And you can see so much of that building with this building trade war, with even countries like Mexico and Canada starting to move away from the United States and to this other trading bloc. You can really see an anti-American trading bloc building right now. So if you can go and read that article, Trade Wars Have Begun, and that will give you a great overview of exactly where this is leading.
Thank you for that, Richard. Moving on, there have been a number of reports lately about how democracy and freedom are retreating around the world. And one nation that is doing its fair share to contribute to that trend is China, a country that many hoped would become a model for an authoritarian nation emerging into greater freedoms. It's really moving in the opposite direction. For the latest evidence of this trend, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, reports came out this week showing that there are 120,000 members of China's Muslim Uyghur minority that are currently being held in re-education camps in the western parts of China. We don't often think of China as having many Muslims, but the Chinese population includes about 23 million. So that's almost the size of Australia. It's a really significant number.
The demographics are always a little greater when you're talking about the most populous nation on earth.
Right. Yeah. When you've got 1.4 billion people, even less than half a percentage, which is what the Muslims constitute, ends up being a massive number. And the Chinese Communist Party, which rules the nation, often has quite a strained relationship with these Muslims. The Chinese Communist Party under Paramount leader Xi Jinping would prefer for minority religions to not really play a forceful role in the lives of Chinese people. But the Muslim faith, as we know, has a tendency to be a pretty potent force in the lives of many of its adherents. So the government really has a strained relationship with many of these Uyghur Muslim minorities. And so they've set up re-education centers where they force individuals who are suspected of acting contrary to party teachings or of being, quote, politically unreliable to go into the camps and be re-educated. And the Chinese authorities say that these re-education centers are designed to eradicate Islamic extremism. And acts of terrorism have been carried out in this part of China, so some of that may well be warranted. But there's also a great possibility for abuse and for human rights violations. And critics of this program say that it goes way beyond combating terrorism and that the goal is to really brainwash and assimilate these Uyghurs into CCP thinking.
What sort of evidence do we have of what's actually happening in these camps?
Well, there's very little at this point. They do a great job of securing these locations. We do know that thousands of people have entered into them and have never been seen again. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, it's there's nothing concrete except that more and more of these camps are springing up and that they, you know, a lot of them end up disappearing certain individuals.
So China does, this wouldn't be the first time that it's undertaken this kind of a procedure.
Not at all. That's part of what makes this so sobering, really. Last year, Xi Jinping was made the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. Actually, it's likely that he's now every bit as powerful as Mao ever was. And at thetrumpet.com, we've written quite a lot about how Xi Jinping has just consolidated his power very rapidly and just how authoritarian he is becoming and how his leadership is coming to resemble that of Mao Zedong more and more. And Mao was notorious for setting up terrible re-education camps all over China when he was at the helm of leadership there. As part of his cultural revolution and his great leap forward, anyone who didn't perfectly toe the line of the Communist Party would be sent to these camps where they would face all kinds of indoctrination and abuse. And tens of millions of people suffered this abuse under Mao, and millions of those died in these camps. So to see Xi Jinping now resurrecting this practice is just one more really sobering indication of his increasingly dangerous authoritarian direction.
If people wanted to more information about why this is important, how to view this in light of the prophecies of the Bible, where would you send them?
Well, the Trumpet has been really carefully watching Xi Jinping's tightening grip on power and his increasingly dictatorial direction because Bible prophecy reveals that as America's influence on the global stage declines, the influence of two other powers will rise up. One of those is a European power led by Germany and steered by the Vatican, and the other one is an Asian power that Bible prophecy calls the Kings of the East. And Scripture makes plain that Russia will be the lead player there, but that China will be in sort of a junior leadership position. And the Bible shows in many chapters, such as Jeremiah 50 and 51, that there will end up being a huge clash between these two entities. So when we see Xi Jinping's increasing control over China's military and over all of China's 1.4 billion people, including all those Muslims, it's just really vital to watch because it indicates how the Chinese president could fall in line with his fellow strongman there in Russia and how China will be brought onto its prophesied collision course against that European power. And I think it also indicates just how near this clash is. So in our show notes, we'll have a link to a booklet written by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And this booklet explains all of these prophecies in very dramatic detail. And I would encourage anyone who's not read that to go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
It's amazing how often these types of stories are coming out of Asia, more and more really concerning trends that we see there. And people really do need to open their eyes to see just how dangerous the threat is as these countries like China begin to get more power. And we see, as we talk about so much, what the times of the Gentiles, as the Bible terms it, are going to look like. Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. And as evidence of China's authoritarianism increases, the Vatican made an interesting move this week, a sign of how it seems to be, well, okay with dealing with China on its own terms. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, in addition to being those 23 million Muslims in China that Jeremiah talked about, there's also 12 million Catholics. And in a fairly surprising move this week, the Vatican seems to have sold most of these 12 million Catholics up the river. And for a little context for this story, relations between the Vatican and China were cut after the Communist Revolution in 1949. And so of those 12 million Catholics, about half of them worship in churches run by the Communist Party and run by bishops who've been approved to teach communist doctrine. The other half, about 6 million, meet in secret, and they're led by bishops who've been appointed by the Vatican. The Pope wants to reunify both this secret church with the official communist church. And so just, within the past few weeks at some point, they sent a delegation to China to take two of these, underground bishops and tell them to resign your post. We're replacing you with two new bishops who've been approved by the Communist Party. And ironically, one of those bishops was actually excommunicated from the Catholic Church in 2011 for accepting a bishopship from the Communist Party without the Pope's approval. And so you see that's a big change now. He's gone from being excommunicated to one of the Vatican's bishops had to resign to make a place for him, because the Catholic Church is moving in this direction, is that we're going to be negotiating with the Communist Party to pick bishops who are acceptable to both of us, which to be acceptable to China's dictatorship means that they have to preach communism and they have to preach the glories of Xi Jinping.
So what does it tell you about the Vatican and why is it making this move?
Right, and that's kind of the shocking thing is one of the bishops of Hong Kong, retired bishop of Hong Kong, was really lamenting the fact that the Pope's betrayed China's Catholics. He's sold them out to this communist dictatorship. And he's like, he actually asked, he's like, said, could the church have negotiated with Hitler or with Stalin? He's like, the church could have never done that. And he seems like a nice man, and I hate to be the one to break this to him, and I don't know what they've told him at seminary. But it is very well documented that the church did indeed negotiate with Adolf Hitler. They signed a concordat on July 20th, 1933, where they promised to keep priests out of politics in return for Hitler allowing confessional schools to operate openly out throughout Germany. So the terms of the deal the Catholic Church made with Hitler are scarily similar to the terms of the deal they're currently making with Xi Jinping's China. And so it does just show that the Catholic Church, and a lot of people don't know this, it's more than a religion or a catechism of doctrines. It is it's a nation state. It's an imperial power that makes concordats with dictatorships around the world. It made one with Hitler. It's making one with Xi Jinping's China. And if you read Revelation 17, it also talks that you'll have, I guess, a concordat or some sort of agreement with a union of 10 dictators in Europe very soon as well. And we have an article up on online right now on this, and towards the end of it, it has some excerpts from Herbert W. Armstrong's classic book, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? that walks you through Revelation 17 and all the symbol. Well, there's a beast, and the beast has seven heads, and one of the heads has 10 horns, and there's a woman that's riding on top of it, and she's got a cup in her hand, and it explains what all of those prophetic symbols mean. So that you'll know that there is this prophesied resurrection of a power in Europe that's comprised of 10 nations, led by Germany and guided by a great false church that has a similar concordat with it as the Catholic Church had with Adolf Hitler in the 1930s.
Go check it out. The name of the article online right now, Vatican Betrays China's Catholics. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed on today's program. Email us your feedback by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Great, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan, and I'll leave you with the words of William Arthur Ward. Feeling gratitude and not expressing it is like wrapping a present and not giving it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.